Good morning. Before we begin, I just want to take the opportunity to spend 2 minutes and start off by expressing my deepest gratitude for all of you spending the weekend with us here, taking the time. I think the dialogue has been instructive. I think it's been fruitful. You're going to hear the rules of engagement for this morning in a minute. And I've already received numerous comments on how to improve for the next summit, some solicited, some unsolicited. And I thank you all for those, and please seek me out if you have additional comments regarding future meetings. Now, as far as this morning goes, I just ask of you one thing. As you discuss the various topics to come to hopefully some agreement as to where this science should move, think of PanCAN, think of the organization, think of us going out to the donor community and raising money for this disease. Because when I sit in front of a prospective donor, they want to know what their money is going toward, very specifically. When I sit in front of somebody and ask them for $100, for $250, for $500,000 toward pancreatic cancer, and I feel very, very confident that PanCAN can raise upwards of $15 to $20 million to fight this disease. But we can't do it just asking a donor to give money toward pancreatic cancer research. That does it to get you a $200 check. That doesn't do it to get you a $500,000 check. And so I ask you to be very, very specific in your comments, specifically guide PanCAN toward where the future direction should be, where the donor model should be. Because you have my commitment that I will do my part to raise the money for you all to continue your work. What you have to give to me is specifics as far as the direction that we need to go. And so I thank you all, and with that, I will turn the meeting over to Jeff.
Thank you, Jason, and I think we all owe you a huge thank you for your vision and your generosity for supporting this meeting. And so I'd just like to give a round of applause to Jason as well. And we have some friends of PanCAN who have spent 4 hours on the highway coming from Los Angeles yesterday. We appreciate that, the McCaskills and Nancy Reardon and Cynthia Strom, who's come all the way from Washington, and we thank you very much for your participation on an early Sunday morning and throughout yesterday. So Jason has given us the challenge, and I think what we need to do is we need to provide the vision for the future. Jason, I think it'd be great if you can raise even more than $20 million for PanCAN, but I don't think that's enough. This is the fourth leading killer of people who are suffering from all cancers. And we've heard about the mortality in this disease. And $72 million just really is not enough from the national level, especially when we're spending $1.5 billion on drugs that are not effective. So what we really need to do is we need to provide PanCAN also with the vision to go to Congress to make sure that we get an appropriate allotment to fight this disease or these diseases that we call pancreatic cancer. So that's our mission today. And I'm glad to say, Bill, that I will no longer be able to go to a meeting and say, I know nothing about pancreatic cancer, because I have learned a huge amount from this meeting, and I thank you all for that. And Inder, I understand, has given in his gold card and Ron his platinum card, because they know enough now also to move forward and to stimulate us actually to work on the problem. So what we wanted to do is get back to, Jason has mentioned this important thing. What can we do? Taking what we've learned in the past 2 days, what are we going to take forward for the next 2 or 3 years to make a significant difference in 2 areas? We know what those 2 areas are. We have to improve early detection. There's just no doubt about it. We've heard the data that if you detect the disease early enough, that if it's resectable, that you can do something about long-term survival. And if we have blood markers, we can detect people even earlier. So what are we going to do about this? How can we develop the markers that will give us a blood test for this disease? Or we heard Roger talking yesterday about imaging. If we can image a disease when it's very, very small, we can use that to guide where surgery will be done and to then perhaps in addition use treatments. And finally, the epidemiology is going to be extremely important. There are families that we know are at risk. We have to be analyzing them, but also we can use data that already exists in order to allow us to evaluate, perhaps we heard yesterday, candidate markers that are developed in mice and vet them in people. Now, I know, and I'm going to ask specifically for the epidemiologists to weigh in on this. What samples do we use that are available? What are the limitations with the currently available samples? Have the tests that have been done, as groundbreaking and important as they are, be improved to take us forward? And I had a very informative conversation with Meg last night, and I know she's dying to say something today. Who do we use these tools on, and how do we use them? And I need you guys to weigh in on that significantly. We've heard about the roles of inflammation. Now, to me, I've heard disparate views on that. Is it initiating the process? Is it promoting tumorigenicity once it starts? Is it a combination of the two? In the talk that Ralph gave yesterday with the mutation of this gene that affects trypsin degradation and starts inflammation early on and gives a, whatever it was, 50 or 100-fold risk of developing pancreas cancer, and those people have chronic pancreatitis from very early ages, it seems to me that there must be a link. How do we benefit from that? Ron has brought up on a number of occasions the importance of stellate cells, and what we've learned is that stellate cells can actually initiate this fibrotic reaction. What do we do about that? Is there a way to target these stellate cells to limit that, and might that, in fact, impact on the next problem, which has to do with treatment? GemSAR is being used as the frontline, I guess, maybe only, substantial method of treatment now, but there are many questions that I've learned in talking with people that we actually don't know the answers to. I mean, how well does the drug get into the organ? There are some people who have substantial responses to this drug. Not very many. Why is it that they're responding? What's different about them? And can we use that difference in order to say, okay, well, these people really would benefit from the drug. There are other people, if they don't have that characteristic, shouldn't even be given it. Remember, it's a $1.5 billion investment each year. We want to use it wisely. We heard yesterday about the importance of personalized medicine. It's something that all of us in the cancer area have been talking about for years. How do we bring that to bear in pancreatic cancer? For example, as Tony Hunter pointed out and as Ron has commented on, the number of kinases that are involved in the pathways involved in cancer are known, and that number is really not going up. And we can actually sequence each of those without too much difficulty and without a lot of expense. Should that be done in pancreatic cancer? Will that inform us about what the targets are? We already have drugs, as I brought up on the first day, because of experiments in other cancers and because these pathways are shared. We already have drugs for a number of these pathways, certainly not all that we need. Can we bring them to bear on pancreas cancer? We haven't done that so far, but is it worthwhile? We don't have to recreate the wheel. We just have to use the wheel in the right way. That, of course, gets back to this issue of, does the organ even have access to any of the agents that we're giving to it, and how do we evaluate that? And finally, what is killing people, as Tony Hollingsworth has so eloquently pointed out, in this cancer as well as others, is the metastatic disease. What do we do about that? We haven't talked about that very much except in a breakout session, but that and RAS are the two 10,000-pound gorillas in the room. So we have to embrace the problem of metastatic disease, and we have to figure out creative ways of doing it. What can we do in the next 2 to 3 years to really make an impact in those areas? I think with that, I'm done. The rules of engagement are: focus your comments. Don't give lectures. Come up with deliverables that can be implemented in the next 2 to 3 years. There will be funding for some of these projects. This is going to form the basis of the strategic plan for PanCAN for the next year or two. And we have to take visionary ideas to Congress to tell them that they are going to be missing out if they don't fund this. In fact, it's their responsibility to do this. We have to be strong in this. And the only way we can be strong is to come up with discrete, visionary, doable ideas. Now, with that, I'm going to turn this over to Roger. He didn't know about this, in order to keep the discussion going in a constructive way. Focus a question. So yesterday, Nabil, where's Nabil?
Nabil is hiding somewhere. He's gone.
Oh, good. Then we can talk about that.
Let's talk about Nabil.
Let's talk about Nabil. So Nabil brought up an interesting model where mice with pancreatic cancer were used in order to discover potential biomarkers and then went into one human populations from the CARROT study in order to validate the markers. There are two questions that come to my mind. One is the mouse model that he used appropriate in order to derive those markers from? And the second is the way that he applied it in the humans appropriate? And if either of those need correction, if they're worthwhile going forward on, do we want to support that as an objective for the future? And then how can we suggest to make it better?
So Nabil's study, this was a comment and then a suggestion. So Nabil's study is an excellent study, but you know, if you cost it and put in the effort into that study, there probably was more cost and effort placed on a mouse proteomics blood study to detect markers of pancreatic cancer than have been done on human studies with the current technologies. Other proteomic studies have been done. You know, this is an evolving field. You know, great study, wonderful samples, etc. But it should have started, in my view, on human samples. So one blood-based biomarker study of high priority could be a large-scale proteomic effort on early-stage pancreatic cancer serum samples. Now, the only thing I would follow that up on is that if you want something done in the next 2 or 3 years, it may be a little bit unrealistic in the next 2 or 3 years because we're not exactly sure how good a blood-based proteomic study will deliver on an optimal marker for the early diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. But we do know that early detection also includes the screening and prevention of pancreatic cancer in high-risk individuals. So we can't forget that early detection includes blood-based markers to detect and diagnose patients, but also screening to prevent pancreatic cancer in high-risk individuals. So a second deliverable would be a national screening study for high-risk individuals defined by family history.
So, you had a comment on that?
Just regarding beginning with mice, one of the ideas, knowing about the study, was to reduce the genetic heterogeneity of the population, to hone in on a few. The idea being that then you can use ELISAs to subsequently screen large numbers of people with much less expense. So at least my interpretation of the study was that they were successful in picking about 60 proteins, of which 20 or 30 ELISAs exist for. So it seemed like it was a good way of getting around the massive expense of screening many, many patients from a genetically heterogeneous background.
I just want to comment that when you actually look at the markers he found, they already have been reported in human biosamples, Reg3, lipocalin-2, TIMP1. Those are all already found studying human samples. But I want to follow up on Mike's comment that I think studying early-stage disease is critical and not to mix in late-stage disease. And also emphasizing peer review, whatever PanCAN does, has to be a critical aspect of it. It should be peer review process. I think that's by far the most important thing in determining how you spend your money.
Right. So if I could just comment on the sample selection too, Ralph, Tony up front. One of the big issues is the identification of reference sets that you can use for identifying these populations. And so, I have a grant with the EDRN where there are people putting a lot of effort into these sorts of things, actually trying to put together these sorts of sets. But one of the real problems is that many people who go out and do biomarker discovery don't use the right control groups when they're actually doing the discovery. So you need to look at cases of early cancer, but in addition to normals, you need to look at individuals with confounding diseases, right? And so obviously pancreatitis is something that people talk about a lot, but actually the bigger confounder in all of these things are people with benign liver disease, which usually frequently confounds these things too. So if we're going to put some sort of a descriptor out for this sort of a big study, I think it needs to adequately address a lot of those sorts of issues.
One other thing I want to mention about biosamples that was mentioned yesterday is this national trial CAPS-3 that involves a number of different centers, 5 or 6 centers, collecting biosamples on patients who are at risk before they develop an invasive cancer. It's, I think, currently underfunded, was mentioned yesterday. What a great opportunity to expand that to other centers, get more biosamples from people with pre-invasive disease, right, and then develop just this type of thing that will be essential for early detection biomarkers. So I would vote for fund more CAPS-3.
So Ron's been waiting over here.
Not being in the field at all, I think that this is an important discussion about how you get early biomarkers and whether you can get enough from humans as early biomarkers seems like it is a challenge. And that is one area where you can model with animals, because you can look at early stage, you can look at every staging component, at least in an animal model, and see whether you get increased inflammatory markers of specific types and how the pancreas is responding to those very earliest stages. And that may be informative for what to look for in humans at various stages. I just don't know how you can get enough patients at the earliest stages to do that modeling. In which do you pit these against each other, the models, or is human versus mouse, or are they both useful?
This is a real huge endeavor and undertaking, and the background and the complexity and the heterogeneity are the biggest problems in trying to sort out the biomarkers from background. One of the things, as a surgeon in the room, that I think we have to do is load this in a way that we have the biggest chance of detecting the difference. And the way we've approached this is to use pre- and post-surgery. So they're all resectable disease or early, all resectable disease patients, all early stage patients with tumor, go to the operating room, reduction in tumor. Maybe there's not all the tumor is gone. We know that because most of these patients are going to recur. But the background of the patient to the patient, whatever diseases the patient has, whatever the background or whatever the heterogeneity in the population, is eliminated because it's the same exact patient being compared to themselves. And if there was one way to go about this, I think that is probably the best way to load the deck in our favor of finding markers.
Do you want to just pass the mic over, and then we'll go to Sunil after that?
And to elaborate on that, I mean, I don't think it should be animals versus humans. I think it should be animals and humans, and we can learn from both of those. The other thing I want to say in response to your idea is that You know, we have patients that we follow that we know have Pannin-3, histologically have Pannin-3. And again, we have people that we followed longitudinally in which we can say, oh, they had a normal EUS to start with, and then they went on to get Pannin-3. Now, that's very valuable material. And so, this would be ideal material to take a look at. Again, you don't have that intrapersonal variation because it's all the same person, but you can go on and look and see what are these Pannin-3 markers.
So we've danced around this issue just a little bit, and I think we need to clarify exactly what we mean by early detection. What stage exactly? Because it seems to me that in a disease that spreads so rapidly after it becomes invasive, what we mean by early detection for this disease has to be Pannin-3. It has to be the pre-invasive state. So I think we should, we're talking about early stage and late stage and things like that. If the goal is to actually affect cure, then today we need to detect this at the pre-invasive stage.
Roger. Again, as someone who knows, who's really ignorant, can I ask, everyone's talking about blood-based, and it seems to me that it would be really good to get pancreatic juice in a non-invasive way. And it occurs to me, why is it that I can't swallow a capsule which has a radio frequency receiver in it? And then as I swallow it, maybe 12 or whatever number of hours later, when it enters my duodenum, so you can check that by an X-ray or some sort of CAT scan, and then we turn on the trigger, and it just opens up and samples, like remote collecting oceanographic device, except it's a couple centimeters under me, and it closes again, and it goes all the way through, and we have to catch it in a bowel movement somewhere later, and then you recover it. And it's got a sample now of my pancreatic juice, and I suspect that would clean things up a bit. And I don't know. Maybe this is either there's some simple reason why this is biologically useless. I'm sure that from an engineering point of view, it's easily doable. And I suspect that it might actually be more meaningful than trying to fish everything out amongst all the incredibly abundant serum proteins.
CAPS3. National study involves pancreatic juice collection. It is a lavaging of the pancreatic ductal system using a natural compound, secretin, an IV injection given during endoscopy. Pancreatic juice is collected at the time of EUS or ERCP. And samples are analyzed for markers. And there's a higher concentration of molecular markers, DNA alterations, genetic and epigenetic, et cetera, in that pancreatic juice. Uh-huh. And we've already shown in CAPS2 that you can get pretty high sensitivity, specificity markers using an epigenetic profile in patients with pancreatic cancer, and we want to translate that into a high-risk population.
But could that be facilitated by not actually having to snake an endoscope all the way down into the necessary region and doing an IV injection? I mean, is there some room for just the engineering improvement? No.
Not in a robust fashion, to be honest. I don't see it happening in a robust fashion. So this is a test that is linked to high-risk screening because patients require, if Terry wants to screen a patient with familial pancreatic cancer, the best test is a very high, accurate endoscopic ultrasound as well as an imaging test like a CT or MRI.
Okay, but it seemed to me that there could be some scope for making it cheaper or therefore and less invasive and therefore applicable to a wider population.
So do you want to stay on early detection technology at this point and methodology or was Jordan, was your point on that?
My point is very much along these lines. First off, Ralph made an important comment and actually Mike's continuing it. The CAPS3 is probably our biggest opportunity right now to do what we need to do. I think that this is a trial where immediately high-risk patients, and it's doing very invasive things. First, you have to realize we do a few things. We drool, we poop, we pee, and we bleed. And those are the things you can access easily. Everything else, pancreatic juice, that's cute. For a high-risk population, it's great, but it's not going to help you in the real world with a larger population. Because remember, most of the patients out there who are going to get pancreas cancer aren't high-risk. They're low-risk. So if you're really going to do something, you have to look for things we do, drool, bleed, pee and poop. And so you better find something in one of those. And I think blood's our best chance. Funding more work on CAPS3 catches Pannins, IPMNs, patients with those, And those are the patients we want to capture to try and prevent this disease. I mean, the basic thing is that we have so far shown, until we get some better treatments, that once this disease is there as disease, we don't do so well. So we need to get it while it's still pan in. So I would say the biggest thing that you can do right now is really look at CAPS-3, how we can make use of it. Yes, maybe you need to do some parallel studies in patients with pancreatitis, patients with liver disease. Second thing, before, because I'm going to have to leave early before before the late thing, the later thing on medicines, realize that I'm chair of Intergroup Pancreas Task Force, and I'm on the executive committee for State of the Science. If this meeting produces a white paper before mid-November, I will promise that it will be part of the package that will go to the people who are involved in State of the Science, many of whom are here. And, of course, anything that comes out for treatment will at least be vetted out or discussed in the task force meetings as part of, you know, can we help with this plan that comes out of this meeting. That's all I can promise out of it. I can't promise people will take it. And I've also asked Mace to be argumentative and obnoxious during the last session.
Tony, did you have you've been waiting for something? Meg?
I would argue that, I mean, I agree with the comments about CAPS-3. However, I would argue that not most of the patients who get this disease are not high risk. I would say we don't understand their risk. And I think that risk is not well characterized. And risk stratification and understanding risk has to go hand in hand with discovery and validation, because otherwise, we can identify markers through whatever model, animal models, humans, validate them in populations that are also not well characterized, and the successful translation into clinical practice will not occur. It will not be an accelerated translation that we desperately need. So in the example of what we saw yesterday, it's a great study. I can't comment on the discovery, but on the validation in humans, I do know that this is a very unusual population for cases, and the controls are not well characterized. We know all of those cases are very, very heavy long-term smokers, and that's unusual, and they were on an intervention. So I think that more attention to those kinds of details, the way that the EPI studies can really help with this, Tony alluded to, because we are working with him in the course of identifying our cases, the majority of which are late stage. We have very few early stage cancers, and there is a consortium within the EDRN that is trying to collect and build a large reference set of early stage cancers, but that's an ambitious undertaking. But we are also recruiting diseased controls beyond chronic pancreatitis, and including patients who were suspected to have pancreatic cancer and were found not to have pancreatic cancer. Perhaps they have another cancer, perhaps they have another disease. But they're very, very well characterized. So you can really tease out risk in that setting. And I just think that we need to emphasize, we can't call someone low risk, you know, or sporadic without really understanding some of the underlying risk principles and doing better risk stratification.
Neil, do you want to go ahead?
So you guys are looking for a early detection serum marker for a very, very low prevalence disease, and you're trying to get it by looking at a very complex pattern of serum proteins and picking stuff out informatically. This is being done in lots of other diseases, and as far as I can see, no progress is being made. And it will founder, many of this founders on the problem of requiring a very, very, very low false positive rate. So even good markers like CEA are useless for screening. So I would say you should at least think about looking at the one marker that has been useful in this regard, and that's PSA. And instead of just looking at serum, take a look at basal membrane of normal pancreas cell, normal ductal cells. Look for proteins that are specific to those membranes and not in serum. Identify them, and then look at what happens in the serum first of advanced pancreatic patients, and then go backwards. Otherwise, you're going to have this goal, I fear, that is really, really a laudable goal, but you're not going to reach it.
So
Can I add one follow-on to that? I think that I was going to... That you said there's you're looking for a needle in a haystack, basically. But then you said, in fact, there is a way to look for the needle in the haystack, which I thought was good, which was PSA. There's other markers, like there's CRP. People are using that for monitoring heart status and other inflammatory status. It's relatively easy to look at several kinds of general inflammatory status markers, which may be changed. But someone else said you made a point about there's no, it's not, they're not really low risk. We just don't understand their risk. But I forgot who made the point about that the precursor to this is some kind of underlying liver. There is an early marker, which is a change in liver function, that may identify the population that you should actually look for some of these other markers in. So you don't have to screen the entire population. You already have a narrowing that improves risk. Is that a real statement? I forgot who made it about the underlying liver component.
Right. Yeah. So I mean, it can be confounding and not too. So if there's a specific, if there's a pancreas specific contribution to the metastatic disease, then you can do that. But you also need to look at benign liver conditions to sort of differentiate those. And I'll add that there are efforts underway also to one of the problems with looking at pan-N3 lesions in serum is that the bulk of the disease is so small that you're going to have vanishingly small amounts of material in circulation from the earliest lesions, and so you're up against problems of sensitivity. There are groups that are looking at autoantibodies against particularly glycosylation-based antigens that appear on certain tumor cells in some of these early lesions. And the idea is that when you provoke an antibody response, this is present at much higher concentrations than the actual underlying disease when you look at this. And so actually profiling those sorts of things is something that's an emerging area. And there are so many targets for that. I would encourage people, as they identify some of these markers, you know, that appear in some of these things, actually consider looking also at autoantibodies that are recognized against those, because they may be higher present at much higher concentrations.
Can I get back to Jason's original comment, though, which is our charge, is that he wants to be able to identify something that will be attractive to donors. And I think maybe we're micromanaging what should be done. I think if we all agree that identifying an early detection test for pancreatic cancer is important, that if you do it and there's a PSA-like test, then I think that'll be attractive to donors. If you get a PSA test out there, then the senators will be getting their PSA for pancreas-specific antigen, and they'll be worried about their pancreas, and they'll increase funding. And then you simply do it through the peer review process. You say, okay, throw it out there. We don't need to tell people it should be glycosylation or it should be this or that, but simply that if PanCAN makes early detection of pancreas cancer a priority, and then go out there for the best ideas and vet them through a peer review process. I don't think we need to micromanage down to.
One deliverable that we could consider putting forward would be the idea of compiling a reference set that would be commonly available for people to use on these discovery things. I think that there is probably general agreement in this room that that would be a good use of funds in the next 2 to 3 years to sort of supplement. And it's the kind of thing that's very difficult to obtain. So if there could be a group that was widely based, you know, broadly represented, that could agree on putting together a big reference set that would be commonly available to people with peer review who could submit tests or discovery series for that, it would be a useful thing.
Could I just ask a question? Would it be useful? I mean, one of the things that we've done is instead of just looking at the static mandate here, we could be actually recording, putting on a screen as we're going along some of these suggestions as they're coming up, so that at least we know what's current. Would that be helpful? So we can just go straight to this computer, in fact, and just type stuff up. I think that'd be more easy.
So I have several points. I have a number of points to make, but I'll limit it to a few. Number one is, I think I'm going to give PanCAN a challenge, because this was something that really changed the way that people thought about studying the genetics of diabetes. The Juvenile Diabetes Foundation in England put together a reagent, basically a set of DNAs on a number of families with diabetes, and then made them available to the research community on demand. And they said, here it is, and we might even give you some pilot grants to study this. That really attracted a number of investigators, a number of creative ideas about how to look at the DNA in juvenile diabetes families. We could do the same thing here. I mean, we have, besides the research that consortium that I have,
I'm sure that a number of those investigators would be quite happy to develop this kind of resource and make it available to the community. In fact, this is a federally funded grant, and we are quite open to sharing the material that we have. It's just that if we could figure out the parameters and the criteria about what would be the definitive set of families, that would be great, or the definitive set of early pancreatic cancer. It's possible. You know, we're doing it at Mayo Clinic. We have hundreds and hundreds of samples that we are willing to make available to the research community. So I think that if we all agreed on what we could do, what would be the ideal set of reagents you need from humans, the people who do the epidemiology and the genetic epidemiology of these people and who actually have that interface with the patients, we can do this. We can provide that. So let me just say that that's one idea. One thing that actually hasn't been, we discussed it in our early detection breakout, but I think there when we talk about risk stratification, we are working on the epidemiology and risk factors for pancreatic cancer. I think that the group knows that there are several, you know, well-known risk factors: smoking, family history, long-standing diabetes, and pancreatitis. Those come out as the culprits. However, there's another way to think about, especially for biomarker development, some characteristics about the disease itself that are giving us clues as to who might possibly have pancreatic cancer. And one of the most amazing clinical phenomena about pancreatic cancer is that it causes diabetes. 75 to 80% of pancreatic cancer patients actually have diabetes at the time of their diagnosis. Often it is undetected. It's not measured. Most physicians don't bother to do a fasting blood glucose on a patient. But we've done that at Mayo Clinic, and we've shown that 74%, I think, of pancreatic cancer patients at the time of their diagnosis have diabetes. Dr. Chari, Suresh Chari, I have to give him all the credit for it because he's really taken a very astute observation about the clinical history of pancreatic cancer and has tried to go back and say, okay, so what's the earliest harbinger of this diabetes? He published a paper about 2 years ago in Gastroenterology in which he showed that if you took a group of new-onset diabetics over the age of 50 and you look to see what happened to them after they developed their diabetes, he found that a number of them actually developed pancreatic or were diagnosed with pancreatic cancer within 3 years. So he took that group of people and estimated, well, what is the probability that if you have new onset diabetes that you're going to actually be diagnosed with pancreatic cancer within 3 years? And he showed that 1 in 125 new onset diabetics who are absolutely, you know, like they look like type 2 diabetics, actually has an underlying pancreatic cancer that probably caused that diabetes. He presented data at the SPORE meeting last month, which he now has a manuscript in review, in which he took a cohort of cases and controls who were over the age of 50. The cases were people who developed diabetes at Mayo Clinic, and this is doable only in a few institutions because he could go back into their medical record for the past pre 60 months, you know, 60 months backwards in time. He took a bunch of controls who were age and sex matched at exactly the same time seen at Mayo Clinic as these patients. And then he showed that the patients who were the controls, the people who just we followed over 5 years, that there was this slight increase in their fasting blood glucose over time, which is what you would expect with age, an aging group. However, the pancreatic cancer patients, when you went back and looked at their fasting blood glucose, there was a rise in their fasting blood glucose. It was not at the level of what you would call diabetes, but it was an elevation. And his data showed that this elevation starts around 3 years out. So these patients have absolutely no detectable lesion in their pancreatic ducts, probably. It's too small. But there is some kind of phenomenon going on where that tumor is causing some kind of beta cell dysfunction and eventually diabetes. So we're actually, you know, trying to think of a lot of different ideas that we can do, and we think that a biomarker actually should be directed to this group of people. And this is, again, sporadic cases. We're not talking about familial. We're talking about the vast majority of people who have pancreatic cancer. I think we should be focusing in on new diabetics and figure out what to do with that group.
So could I just interject one thing here? Because I actually want to go back to Ralph for a second. And to Jason's earlier remarks, there's a piece here that was in Science magazine itself about a couple of months ago. It was about framing science, and the argument was to engage diverse public, scientists must focus on ways to make complex topics personally relevant. There's part of the way in which you're going to have to use this information, the strategies that you decide are the most important ones, are also going to have to be comprehensible to the people you go to for money, I assume. So I don't see any disconnect between trying to get this clarified and sharpened so that it would make sense to lay people as well. So you were making a specific suggestion there, which was to say, point one, can we all agree in the room that a primary function is to early detection methods, right?
Yeah, so let's develop an early detection method for pancreatic cancer. Subpoint one, define who's at risk. Subpoint two, define the precursor lesions that give rise to pancreatic cancer. And subpoint three, develop a marker. So you define who's at risk, what the precursors
just
are.
Just say that once again so that Katie can actually type that fast.
Develop a marker.
Well,
Well, yeah, I think we should get into the imaging thing, but let me just let me just interject here for a second, which is I do think that if we spend here 2.5 days coming up with these things, each one of us, before we came into this room, could have put these things up there without having to spend these 2 days discussing them. So, you know, I have to go back to Jason's charge and say, it's true, Ralph, that we should not micromanage how people will do whatever they're going to do. But I do think that we're going to do a much better job by stratifying within these categories something that we're going to give him the tool to basically focus on one initiative over the other, as opposed to saying to a donor, give your money for early detection. Because, you know, I mean, this is not something that we needed to do here.
I guess one of the points that I was making was that from talking to you all and from listening to it, I mean, there was clearly no agreement. I didn't sense any general agreement about the complementarity of the methods. I mean, there would be people who would be saying, well, mouse model, what's that going to tell you? We were looking at all these confounding factors in humans, and it's very complicated. And then we need the early detection because we need to sort out the confounding variables and so on. So what do you put your priorities onto? That's what I'm trying to figure out from here.
Well, let me just start off by saying that we have to decide as a group whether, you know, each one of us have their, of course, favorite model system based on experience, sure, based on philosophy. So either we decide a priori that we're going to come up out of this discussion with everybody putting up their own favorite idea, at which point, you know, we basically probably have not achieved necessarily what we wanted to, or we are prepared, irrespective of our different opinions, to put up something that we're all going to subscribe to, the idea that at this point in time it's the best thing to go. To me, what it looks like is that the discussion is revolving around everybody presenting their, which is fun and is important, but I'm not sure we're going to achieve what we were charged with. So
I mean, let me just, I mean, I think there are complementary points, and one, you can have these broad areas, and then two, as Tony hinted at, there's some group shared resources, such as a group bank, or the group agrees to help support something like CAPS-3 type of initiative that benefits everybody. And I think the value of sharing ideas is better ideas are created, and we may have different ideas at the end of the two-day session, but we'll go home with our own ideas, and then that'll help us if we want to apply for one of these with better ideas. I don't think the group, it'll just be who's the loudest, otherwise, if you come up with specific suggestions.
Right.
But and shared banks and things and that type of an idea, in addition to the very broad areas, I think is something that the group can accomplish today.
Let's go back to the room.
Yeah. I think you have made a very good point. We are not going to make a process. We understand, all of them seem to agree, we need an early detection, whether it's a mouse model or a human, whether it's span three or not. That's really for the group of experts, what you call here a peer review system, has to make a decision. You can make a broad parameter of what you're expecting from them. We are not going to make a decision here because everybody has their favorite. So I think to move forward, I suggest strongly we take your recommendation and move forward on this.
Craig.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment. So I completely agree with Ralph that having early detection and letting peer review choose specifics is the way to go. But I also agree that, I mean, it sounds to me like there's a lot of agreement that having a really well-defined reference set that everyone can use, I think there's widespread agreement for that. So that's 2 points. And then one thing I haven't heard people talk about is, so there's a lot of discussion here about, you know, new discovery. The reality is, the things that we heard yesterday that were discovered in this mouse model were already known, as Ralph pointed out. And we have a lot of candidate markers that people just haven't studied because the validation aspect, it's hard if we don't have antibodies. So there's a lot of molecules we already know about. We haven't even looked. So we're going to spend a lot of effort to do a lot of new discovery when we haven't even looked at the ones we've already discovered. And I think you could go to people and you could say, we've done a lot of good work. We've learned a lot. We have a lot of candidates. Let's test them.
Neil.
I guess I'd like to go against my friend Inder and support the other New Yorker here. I think what I haven't heard, this is really stuff we've known for 20 years, and maybe we should discuss the properties of the early detection marker that we are looking for that it has to have in order for it to have any utility. It has to have incredibly high sensitivity, ridiculously low specificity. It has to have a cost that is reasonable given the amount of people who are going to have to be screened. And I really think most people with early high blood glucose do not have pancreatic cancer. Who are you going to screen? What are you going to do? What properties does this assay have? We all want this. The question is it feasible? It's been looked at in many other diseases with except for one instance, failure. The test has to have certain properties.
Neil, can I ask a question about the blood glucose, since you raised it and I was curious about it and that issue came up? Because I look at type 2 diabetic models, and where insulin resistance is the early hallmark of that. But in people, it's almost always linked to obesity. And I didn't know if that is the same case for the people that present with pancreatic cancer, because if it isn't, then it's a very different way to present the high glucose.
I want to sharpen the point.
That would be a very distinct subset.
All right, I want to sharpen the point and then let somebody who actually knows about it. What the test would have to be is in non-obese people with hyperglycemia. We're talking about 37,000 new cases a year of pancreatic cancer. How many cases a year are there of no other risk factor, lean adult hyperglycemia? Because if it's a small number...
That's a very small number. That's a small number. I can tell you that.
I would... How small? Very small. I'd like a little more quantitative.
She said 1 in 125. So...
That's not
total all comers.
Almost all type 2, adult onset type 2 diabetes is linked to obesity. And hyperlipidemia and other common risk factors. If you subtract out the obesity component, that's a much narrower group.
One of the problems, though, is that increased body mass index is, at least according to some studies, one of the putative risk factors for developing pancreatic cancer. So it is a little bit confounding there when you sort of look at that specific.
Well, I wouldn't disregard the fact that pancreatic cancer candidates would also be overweight because there are a fair number of people. But the fraction of diabetics and insulin-resistant people who are lean, and that's a real that's an identifiable number. I know that some of the diabetologists' friends are interested in that group because it's a specialty group. But if a fair fraction of people with high risk are in that group, that's a much narrower population. And Neil, I can't tell you what it is, but it's definitely a small slice of that bigger pie.
So that's something that could be addressed.
We need to sort of move forward because we have a lot of other topics to discuss here. So we've been reminded that we, in the spirit of deliverables, we still need to sort of come to some consensus. And so I think we've agreed that is there a common consent then from the group that a general call for these sorts of studies would be good, reiterating that, and then also trying to put forward the proposal for a very specific biorepository, maybe compiling that sort of thing. Right. Right. So,
can I make a point about, I think there's still an intellectual debate going on about markers, and as Neil says, there is not a marker that exists currently in any disease that would be able to be useful as a screening test for a disease that has a prevalence of 1% of patients overall. And at any one point in time, the prior probability that someone has pancreatic cancer is so low. So let's say we had a very good early detection blood or a blood test for pancreatic cancer. First of all, it would not be used other than as a diagnostic attempt at a diagnostic test on patients who present with symptoms. But we do not know if someone presents with symptoms of pancreatic cancer, whether or not having a blood test today or a one-month workup would actually change the natural history of that population. Now, in fact, we have early detection tests that are not that good. We have imaging tests, conventional endoscopic imaging and CT-based imaging tests that are not perfect tests. It's sort of like analogous to mammography. All right. So patients get a very invasive test to look for early breast cancer, and that's mammography. We actually have imaging tests that are available now to target high-risk individuals. So I think we have to be cautious about believing that if we get a blood test, that suddenly we're going to solve pancreatic cancer because we're going to have solved early detection. So yes, screening involves... a different consideration than a diagnostic test.
Yeah, but let me just remind you of those three questions again, which you can't see them. The first one, which Tony's trying to get through, is how do we develop an early detection tool for this disease? And we looked at blood-based biomarker evaluation, imaging, and epidemiology. Are you comfortable with...
Wait, I really feel I need to make a point, and that is that an early detection biomarker is the Holy Grail. It's landing a man on the moon. The fact of the matter is, we often can't tell chronic pancreatitis from pancreatic cancer. There are a lot of other biomarkers that would be clinically useful, that would save time, that would save money, that would save lives, and they aren't early detection biomarkers. They're just clinically useful biomarkers. And if we get too hung up on trying to get the hardest goal, we might miss a lot of really valuable things. So let's not try to land a man straight on the moon. Let's orbit the planet first.
So agreeing with you would be Inda, right? And Ralph? And...
I only said that because I've been hearing it that this is one of the few diseases where from the time that you get the disease to the time...
It's hopeless. It's very short. And therefore, an early detection here or some detection here will be more useful compared to diseases where there's a considerably long period. That's why I thought there was a considerable emphasis to do that.
Could we get the microphone to Dr. Isakar? Bill?
Yeah. If I could have had the disease for a long time, and you don't detect it. So from the time of detection till the time you die is very short. You're detecting it late.
Yeah.
You've had the disease a long time. 90% of it is subclinical, so we're not detecting it.
Can I ask the dumb question from the outside, do we really need a pancreas the cancer-specific marker, would it be enough to have a tumor-specific or a malignancy specific marker that people would take happily and spend more money on because it could detect a wide range of cancers, and then later, as long as it includes pancreatic cancer as one of the conditions that it catches, then people would then, in a secondary or a one-and-a-half step, we would then try to figure out which cancer it is. And I just suspect that one could afford to pay a lot more. And also, when you ask for this incredible specificity, if we design it only as pancreas-specific cancer, a lot of the false positives may turn out to be they have cancer somewhere else, which is, from the patient's point of view, extremely valuable to know.
Tony,
just as valuable. And they, those will be more prevalent.
Okay, we just need to move forward in the interest of time now, too. So I think that, okay, Gloria.
Let me reiterate the challenge for PanCAN. I think that PanCAN should sponsor or support, just like the Juvenile Diabetes Foundation did with the human reagents, a very defined set of panels or human reagent panels that they will make available to the scientific community. And the biomarker guys can do whatever they want, but if they use this panel and validate it in it, it's going to enormously move the field forward. We cannot have boutique biomarker studies on these really weird kind of samples and validation samples. It just is not going to be, nobody will buy it. But if PanCAN will support, this is the standard that we want all the biomarker labs to be using, you're going to enormously, it'll just be accepted, it'll be a given. And so then people will just say, yeah, I believe this data. You won't have this kind of, I don't believe the study that was presented yesterday or the one that was presented last week at another meeting. I mean, because they were too, it was like comparing apples and oranges. What PanCAN can do is provide a basket of apples to the entire scientific community. That is what I think they should be investing in. I think that every donor who has a loved one with pancreatic cancer or a donor who has pancreatic cancer, the light bulb is going to go on. Of course, I developed diabetes. My doctor found diabetes a year ago in me. This is really going to resonate, I think, with the community.
Okay, Jeff. Jeff, did you have a comment?
So I want to go back to something that Ralph said that reflects on this discussion and a point I think that you just made, Gloria, that might move us forward. And that is that, and it's something that Roger was getting at too, is that I think if you have a multi-component test, it may be extraordinarily valuable. So if you had a general tumor marker plus an indicator that would be more specific for diabetes, such as abnormal glucose in the absence of other symptoms in a lean population, then you're really going to hone in on that individual. And it gets to what you were saying, that you know, you're not shooting for the moon here, and from Roger was saying you're getting something that could be generally valuable, and so you use the disease physiology in order to inform you where the likely organ site is. So relevant to what Ralph was saying, let's let the peer review system vet this. We know what the problem is. This is not a new problem. This was identified in the past several think tanks. This has to be done. What we do have now is some new information that you presented, and Meg told me the same story last night. Meg, you haven't said anything, but it sounded to me like the story you were telling me is pretty much the same as the story that... okay, so that's two completely independent, unless it's the same, but it's two completely independent things. So there's truth there. There's truth in that. It hasn't been known. It's new information that allows us to go forward in a new and informed way. So what I suggest is that we know what the problem is. We know what the goal is. Let's come up with some proposals that are the most creative to take advantage of this new information to move forward. And let's get some synergy, which is what Bill's point was from the beginning. There are people from different perspectives here, such as Roger, myself, Ron, et cetera, that could perhaps participate in this from different perspectives to get together the synergy that we need to advance this forward.
So would you like to propose one of those areas then?
It's what you've got here. So well, the idea is to make an RFA, early detection.
But is there something that you're not hearing from that side?
I'm just trying to bring it together. That's all.
You need a
resource. So if that doesn't exist, then that is what is needed. And
if you want to do something in the next 2 years to have an impact, that would be a good thing to do.
Jack, yeah, Scott. I would totally agree with that. With the one additional thought that it might be worth sort of discussing this with NIH or at some additional level, just because to make sure that these samples really are a national resource. But
right.
Yes, right. I understand.
I wanted to make a quick point of go back to where we were coming up with sort of general categories of things that we think we should focus, and how can we make those a little bit more specific so you can sort of sink your teeth into it and get donors to get excited about this sort of thing. I think that Ralph had mentioned something yesterday about we have to find an early detection method for Panin-3. It's not just saying early detection for pancreas cancer. I think you've got to find... you've got to look at clinical problems that we have currently. You've got a group of patients who are diabetic, early onset diabetes at a certain age group, at a certain weight. What's the biomarker? That's a clinical thing that's been identified. What's the biomarker that will separate those patients out? Look at IPMN. I mean, we have a huge clinical problem. I mean, if I go down to radiology, I can see 3 to 5 cysts a day at Indiana University. Which ones have IPMN high-grade dysplasia or the functional equivalent of Panin-3 in those groups of patients? I mean, these are key markers that we need to find. If the pancreatitis thing is another one, we could... And I think these, in any white paper that's generated, I mean, this group has spent a lot of time trying to identify what the key mark... If there are markers in the serum or... urine or pancreas juice that have not been tested, and there's 20 of them that, even the institutions with the best resources can't get through in the next 2 to 3 years, then why don't we make that information available to come up with a collaborative grant so that these can be detected and this work can be accomplished quicker. So I think we should mention specific biomarkers for specific clinical problems. I don't think we're going to land a guy on the moon in 3 years with this disease with a marker that everybody can take after they're born. But maybe through looking, like Ralph says, okay, looking in the areas where the big game is, the CAPS-3 study. We have a study actually at Indiana University where we're taking patients with IPMN.
We need to go forward, Max, a little bit.
Well,
so Steve,
he's waiting for Steve, actually. He's got a microphone.
Yeah, Steve.
I like the idea very much of PanCAN funding infrastructure, and I think that that's an attractive sort of big idea to take forward to donors and let the peer review process sort out some of the details. We are going to be the peer review, and this meeting, I think, has been incredibly illuminating for all of us to get a broader perspective on what ideas are out there, and that's going to augment our ability to peer review grants that come in solicited by these ideas. In terms of infrastructure, I just want to make a plea that infrastructure to conduct these types of studies using available mouse models should also be considered. We've heard the benefits of studying the mouse in a genetically homogeneous background. The mouse currently is also clearly our most abundant source of Panin-3s to study. And so there are still huge barriers to bringing mice into any institution, even from JAKs, and to come up with a biorepository of mouse serum, tissue, et cetera, from a select group of models with Panin-3s to be freely distributed within the community, I think would be another similar infrastructure that would have a high impact and accelerate the pace of both discovery and applied work.
Common agreement with
I agree fully with Stephen. I want to make one point about the infrastructure, though, is that make sure it's not duplicating something that's already being done. The right. EDRN is paying $1,000 for a serum sample for someone with early pancreatic cancer to set up a giant bank. I think it would be counterproductive to set up a competing bank to a central one. So I think being aware of what's already ongoing when you set up the infrastructure, set up a unique infrastructure that doesn't overlap with what someone else is already funding.
Yeah. Tony, do you want to move forward on Twitter?
I want to make one quick point before we finish. I have to get this in there. So every time we discuss early detection, we discuss biomarkers.
You know, if we take a look at breast cancer, for example, this is not that different if we were the breast cancer community. And remember, I study biomarkers. I look for biomarkers. You know, we have mammography, so we can image breast cancers, but let's spend all our resources, all our time, because we don't really want to have patients go through a screening test that's difficult like mammography. Let's get mouse models together. Let's spend millions and millions of dollars on a blood test to diagnose breast cancer early so we wouldn't have to do imaging, mammography. So you can't focus entirely on a blood-based test to diagnose early pancreatic cancer.
Right.
We already know that screening high-risk individuals with standard clinical tests done carefully can diagnose pre-invasive disease and cure patients. So it's not all about a blood test to diagnose and prevent pancreatic cancer.
Right. So what we were going to try to move on to was a brief consideration of imaging in the context of early diagnosis, right? Yeah, in 6 minutes, which is about what we have left, right? So maybe we've done that now. I mean, I think that there should be also consideration, as RFA, right, to improved imaging techniques in the context of some of the nice things that have been presented, right?
So the one thing I would just say, Jeff, the same point that was made, that should be both. I mean, one should also look in the long term, and so look at molecular imaging and such, and so that should be both human and mouse,
right,
as well.
Right. I think that's agreed. And so for imaging, what's needed would be recommended would be better imaging techniques, new probes, you know, smart probes.
And supportive,
right. And Terry?
I just wanted to bring up one little back of the envelope calculation I did. So to find one patient out of 10,000 that has pancreatic cancer, to make it cost effective, and this is a little cost, a little envelope measurement I made, but in general, the cost of the test needs to be about $25 to make it cost effective for average risk population, not higher risk. So I just thought I'd throw that on. You don't have to. You can increase the risk. The epidemiologists will help us stratify risk, but I just want to throw out, when we think about early diagnosis, we should also include people that are regular risk and just think about what is the cost of the test.
Right.
Can I just say that from the point of view of imaging, I would not try to build a test that was specific for pancreatic cancer. The whole point of imaging is it has spatial resolution, and you should try to devise a test that will find nearly any cancer. Then you can afford to spend a lot more money, and if it just happened to show up in the pancreas, that will come out naturally. But you want to be sure you can include pancreas as one of the things you can detect. But I don't think it's practical to do, except in the very most high risk, is to build an imaging technique that is extremely tied to just pancreas. It can be something where there's a specific component, like a generalized antibody or phage display or some sort of test which might have a little bit of specialization, but it has to be fairly generic, I think, for all tumors in order to be.
I agree with this specificity. Right. I want to make a comment about imaging, just as I think Max mentioned about biomarkers for early pancreatic cancer, or PANN3. I think better imaging specifically to resolve IPMNs and PANN3s that are curable lesions. And I think right. They can detect colon polyps as well. That's not the issue, but they should be specific or sensitive enough to detect PANN3 and IPMNs. And I think that would be invaluable.
Right.
We're trying to flip back to the other screen, by the way. It's just that the password doesn't work. So that
okay.
Is that Jeff? Is that what you're asking me?
No, I was just saying that in that bracket should probably be one
button. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So as we're running out of time, one more consideration is identifying high-risk populations. This is something that was discussed at length, I think, with Ralph. And so, with the advent of genetic tests and some of the these things, this may be a segue to some of the therapeutic things that we'll talk about later on, but the idea of actually identifying at-risk populations, is there some brief discussion about, tests perhaps to do that or strategies to best accomplish that?
Meg, should we go to you for that, I think?
Well, I think
can you just hang on a second, please? Thank you.
Gloria really laid the foundation for so much of this work through the recruitment, the identification and recruitment of high-risk families. What we have done is that we're extending it into the general population, and the challenge for doing that is really the rapid ascertainment of cases, since even in our setting when we're identifying these cases, as they're occurring in real time in community settings, 20% of them are dying, and of those, three-quarters die within 30 days of diagnosis. So I think that this really underscores that there has to be an investment, not only, I mean, I think that the two approaches are very complementary, the focus on high-risk families and the building on this tremendous resource of this enriched sample. And I also think that the investment, the parallel investment, is to really focus on large segments of the population in the community. That's where we're going to get our African Americans. That's where we're going to get our Hispanics. That's where we're going to get diversity. And that's also where we have opportunities. And this is something that is untapped, but where we can really improve detection, diagnosis, and treatment in community settings, which even for pancreas cancer is where the vast majority of cases are diagnosed and treated. So I think that these are the kinds of efforts that, along with the specimens that accompany these data, that are really going to help us identify strategies as the tools become available, as they go through discovery, as they go through validation, again, to get at translation and how can we improve outcomes.
I just wanted to add, maybe in parallel to the discussion that we had for early detection, that if we embrace the concept that running in parallel the human aspect of this investigative field and using modeling, one of the things that I think we are missing on the modeling side in the animal setting is risk modeling. So most of the models that we have now really lay out the basis for the genetic aberration that we see to drive the disease full-blown. And we have, I think at this point in time, very little by way of trying really what we heard from Mariano about his model, but we have very little models that really try to model the risk on the background, perhaps, of these mutations. So perhaps this is, again, something that we can consider in the category of assessing risk, that it should be something that the community will incorporate into the portfolio of their modeling.
In this original slide that we had, that Jeff brought out, we had how do we detect an early detection tool for disease, that we did the blood-based biomarker evaluation. We talked about we're on imaging. I'm assuming I'm conflating here the epidemiology and who right. do we use the tool on.
Right.
So just to remind you that that's question two is in there.
Right.
As well.
So it's now 9:45.
Yeah.
Right. This is when we were meant to stop. Is that right?
That's when we were. That's when. Yes.
Right.
we're supposed to stop. That's when the nodding head said we're supposed
right.
to stop.
Right. And so, I guess it's the consensus of the group. Do we need a break at this point to discuss that?
Or do you want to do information?
Should we have a brief consideration of the other topic that was raised, which was the more elucidation of the role of inflammation, cancer?
I think.
Consideration of that?
I think we should just do that all at one time.
Yes. Right.
Okay.
Who has an opening remark on the inflammation issue?
Thea.
Inflammation is probably one of the earliest hallmarks of how the lesion starts, even before Panin 3, probably at the very earliest inception. And so I think that it probably plays a dual role, both initiator and promoter. So finding markers of initiation of inflammation and being able to isolate it to the pancreatic setting, I think, is going to be critical.
Now, Ron, you should. Do you have some comments on this as well? Oh, Steve has something. Enda. Well, you're in the dark. That's why I can't see.
No, that's okay. I know that. Near the church, farther from God. Remember that.
His dark materials.
I just want to reemphasize what Thea said. Again, I think we need to know what is inflammation. What is pancreatitis? what is the marker for that? Because I heard yesterday from Neil the Contrarian that pancreatitis really doesn't mean much because lots of people have pancreatic cancer and pancreatitis is not an important component of that. So if that is the case, then what do we need to study? What really is the question of inflammation? And to me, inflammation, as someone who works on it, has multiple components. Is it really release of a lymphokine? Is it really the movement of neutrophils? What is it that we are looking for in the case of pancreatitis? We need to have a real clear definition of what markers we are looking for. That's an important component.
Ron, could you?
Since I'm interested in inflammation and metabolism in general and in insulin resistance and diabetes, I take Thea's point as being we see that inflammation is a very early marker, and you work on this as well, that inflammation is a key component in developing insulin resistance. And so we don't have to define that here. I think that what we've said is that there is an underlying pathway that can be dissected that for which we who are not in the field, but there is a pathway that can be applied, a paradigm that can be applied to try to understand what are the important components of inflammation, what are the key cells, what's the role of the macrophage, the stellate cell, et cetera. That now becomes a very specific way to begin to explore the underlying sort of cellular and genetic basis of the inflammatory process, because that is an area that has a lot of basis in other areas, from other cancers to, in my area, metabolism and inflammation.
Mariano's model is, yesterday, may have really nothing to do with pancreatitis
Just to crystallize this in sort of a pancreas-specific way, I'd like to echo, I think, a point that Terry made yesterday, that calling the expansion of stroma and the cellular infiltrates that accompany various forms of pannins chronic pancreatitis is a gross oversimplification. And I think that we can support studies that dissect both the cellular and acellular components of stroma following cerulean injection in the setting of clinical chronic pancreatitis without neoplasia, in the setting of apparent pancreatitis accompanying neoplasia, and the simple description of these various categories of inflammatory response that we lump together as chronic pancreatitis needs to be dissected by detailed flow characterization of cellular components, proteomic and other analysis of acellular components, and we really need to answer these questions but placed in specific categories of disease and non-disease and animal models that allow us to distinguish between these entities in a pancreas sort of centric fashion.
Obviously it's multifactorial thing. You could have all the inflammation you want and it's not going to get in all the time in pancreatic cancer. We can develop, and we do all the time, pancreatitis, both acute and chronic, and at least in mice and rats and whatever, almost none of them get pancreatic cancer. So just because there's some inflammation, that doesn't mean it's necessarily going to be pancreatic tumor and other inflammation in pancreas itself. And as far as, what are the mediators of inflammation in pancreatitis? We have really no clue. I mean, you can make a list of 30 different things, which, when I give a talk, I have a list of like 25 mediators of inflammation in pancreatitis, and that's just scratching the surface. So it is, a lot more sure. We really, really don't know what are the inflammatory mediators of pancreatitis and how they affect pancreatic cancer is just far cry.
So could we get a mic to
Theo? And while we're coming up, if we need to refocus this in terms of deliverables with the two to three-year idea. So this is a nice discussion of the concepts, I think, but are there specific proposals for things that could be put forward, further study of this, et cetera? Theo?
So when I made the original comment, I was trying to be focused, and I was trying to be focused on the role of inflammation in the initiation and the promotion. I heard a lot of discussion about some of the confounding factors. That is a separate issue. But if you look at the early premolecular, premalignant lesions in many types of cancer, and includes pancreatic, there is a severe upregulation of cyclooxygenase 2. It's an inflammatory marker. It causes this whole cascade to turn on. So specifically, I'm saying that some of the earliest events in premalignancies has to do with the activation of the inflammatory response within the epithelial cells, and there's a responding conversation from the stroma. And to take that apart, I think, would be extremely useful. That should be studied.
I wanted actually to put it as a question, maybe to take on what Roger suggested before in terms of imaging and overlay it on the aspect of inflammation, and ask the question whether there is a room for a thought that imaging inflammation is going to be something that is going to be very important, and how one goes about doing it. Now, granted, there are going to be a lot of probably non-specific signals that one detects there, but whether this is going to be something that will focus then the attention of the clinicians, the patients, the scientists on early detection modalities that are, at least are based on inflammation. And this is something that I have spoken to people that are doing imaging, and in fact, I don't think it has been done much. Any comments on whether this is something that we should be investing in?
So, Brian, don't you? I was going to go to Brian actually at the back, but is this a direct follow-up?
This is direct. Okay. There has been some imaging work for in type 1 diabetes where you can actually see changes of the vascular permeability of the vessels in the pancreas. So, I mean, there are some modalities that are using that, sort of fluorescent labeled iron nanoparticles that have been used, and they have taken it. They're doing a clinical trial of that. It seems they're not sure whether it's actually doing much, but there is a.
So this is this one thing that exists out there.
There
but
is
I'm just
something
asking
that exists now.
To what extent this is something that is worthwhile investing in?
So let's stay on this point.
On the imaging of inflammation, I think the first thing is to separate in mouse models versus in people. In mouse models, it's a lot easier, of course, and nearly all of the sort of cellular tricks we now can have now people are beginning to apply at just a few labs to say, look at kinase activation, gene expression. All of those can be made into in vivo imaging methods that can be applied to whole animals. Bioluminescence resonance energy transfer takes the place of fluorescence resonance energy transfer, but even kinase markers, kinase activity, one of the harder things to measure online, can be done in an intact animal. Just a few labs doing it. Very appropriate now to call for expansion of these new techniques just coming online. They haven't been applied to pancreas, but they could be. I think that's very doable. Something that's directly applicable to people, where you cannot make a luciferase mouse, et cetera. I mean, you can't put luciferase into a human directly, is trickier. But again, I would imagine that with it would probably be an antibody-based approach to begin with, where obviously there's a lot of markers on the surface of inflammatory cells, and those could be tracked and so on. So again, it's a little tougher. But I think it's doable. And if you go to the molecular imaging meetings, there's lots of interest in imaging inflammation, but not that much particularly applied just to pancreas, because, of course, it's relatively rarer than the other cancers. But you can piggyback off the work being done in the other cancers, because I don't think it's that different, intrinsically different.
So, Brian, you've been waiting for a while.
So I guess I just wanted to try and address Tony's request for a deliverable. And just to say that if we're thinking of trying to understand and dissect inflammation, I would like to make the self-serving suggestion that maybe probably a key initial way to do this is actually through mouse models. And the reason for that is you can go in and you can, you know, dissect very readily, you know, you can knock out genes, do genetic manipulation, and in that way sort of very rapidly modulate what type of inflammatory response you will get in response to tumor initiation and progression. I think very much like the work that Mike Caron has done with regards to liver cancer. And I think we can then take that information, which we can generate, I think, fairly rapidly using good mouse models of pancreatic cancer that we have, and then go back and see how that correlates with what we see in the human patient population. I think it's, you know, given the more genetic homogeneous nature of the mouse or mouse models, it's much easier to do that initial dissection there and then translate that information over to a much more complex system.
Neil?
I think that there is a fundamental question that we are missing so far that does provide deliverables. It's clear that familial chronic pancreatitis is associated with the disease, and it's clear that inflammation is associated with the disease. So Thea's suggestions and Ron's about understanding inflammation are very important. What is not clear is that whether the great mass of sporadic pancreatic adenocarcinomas are associated with inflammation or not. And therefore, it is not clear whether all these models and all this work actually is relevant to the mass of pancreatic adenocarcinomas. So the question I asked yesterday ignorantly about why isn't alcoholism a big risk factor? To me, the question is the mass of pancreatic adenocarcinoma, is inflammation a precursor? So that's the deliverable. I don't know how to get to that, but I think that's the question that has to be asked before you throw everything into inflammation models and understanding. And the sort of little question I have attached to this is the first data that COX-2 or PG mediators could prevent polyps came from large-scale epidemiologic studies on NSAID use or aspirin use, and I just wonder if that has been looked at in pancreatic cancer.
Is there a response to that, Maggie?
Well, I might just maybe by way of responding, but maybe just coming back to the issue that I raised before, and that is that in a lot of these cases, and I'm quoting actually what Terry told me from her clinical data, the major problem is that the inflammatory conditions are asymptomatic. So you really don't know that an inflammatory process is going on, even in people that are not necessarily alcoholic. And so the question is,
that's not important. You know that it is going on in patients who binge drink every 3 days. And you know they don't have a big increase in pancreas cancer.
Well, you don't know what the reason for that is. It may be because they die of cirrhosis.
No, it hasn't been measured. I mean, if we look at the state of the science for population science for pancreas cancer compared to any other tumor, including brain, we really are very far behind. And the reason for that is because all of the prior population efforts have included only a select group of patients who survived long enough to be identified, interviewed, and get specimens. Now, what Gloria is doing in high-risk families and through referral centers, and what we're doing by capitalizing on electronic medical records and surveillance of these records to identify patients in real time, are really the efforts. The problem with the alcohol so far is that the measurement is terrible. We've taken a different tact in our study, and in fact we're seeing a much higher prevalence of alcohol use in cases than what's been previously reported, but these are very early results. So we don't have the kind of understanding in terms of risk factors in the population that we have for almost any other cancer, because the survival time is so short that it's so challenging to study in this way.
Let me just add the one observation that we do know is that it does appear that regular aspirin use is protective. So we are looking at protective risk factors as well, protective factors.
Steve?
As well. Modest. Yeah, it's a modest. But there's a there. The data suggests that you know there's a dose response, and you know that the, there's more protection with heavier or more frequent use.
But just to
speak to
Steve, Neil's, this is the last point.
To
I think
speak
then
to Neil's
to
point
break.
Directly, you know whether or not inflammation is a precursor to sporadic disease, it's an almost universal co-traveler with even early lesions. And I think that that is a distinctive feature of pancreatic cancer. The magnitude of the stromal and cellular infiltrate that occurs is a unique feature of pancreas cancer. And even if you could imagine that that didn't somehow synergize with the epithelial component of the disease, I think better understanding it is going to provide opportunities for imaging, et cetera, that ought to be embraced. So I'm not sure it needs to be a precursor to deserve emphasis.
Okay. What would your deliverable be, Meg, if you had it?
What's?
Yeah, I mean, what's an epidemiological deliverable?
What we're planning to do is expand. You know, Gloria's efforts are continuing to grow. Our efforts are continuing to grow. We're planning to expand our study so that we will be able to recruit more minority populations, and these resources are available. And so I think that the idea of risk modeling is something that's also come up before, and we're just not there yet. If we put the inputs that we have for risk modeling, similar to the tools that are available for breast cancer, for example, those inputs are simply not good enough yet because they're from very select populations. And we need something that is really going to be more reflective of the range of risk and the range of disease that we see in the population as a whole.
But in terms of this larger strategy of these points, these points that they need to actually use, obviously these are all intertwined. But there seems to be kind of a circular argument here. Where's what are the acupressure points? Where do you go first?
No, I think that, well, here, I'm going to give this to Thea.
Thea.
I know she's going.
Well, we're talking about apples and oranges, and both are very important, but we're talking across purposes. So a lot of people are talking about innate and adaptive immunity and inflammatory responses, et cetera. Yes, that's very important, probably not only in starting the cancer, but modulating it. But what I was talking about in the beginning is what's happening in the actual tumor cell. And if you go to premalignant lesions in the pancreas, in the breast, in the prostate, in several different tissues, what you find is the overexpression of cyclooxygenase 2, which is turning on an inflammatory response that modifies not only the epithelial cells, but also the microenvironment in a conversation. This is separate from the big picture of innate and adaptive immunity. They probably connect at some point, but it's different. And so deliverable is try to measure and image what's happening in the early pre-malignant lesion. Because if you can pick that up, you've got the beginning of cancer. And it's also telling you whether it's going to progress or not progress.
And that's something you would go and seek. That's a case you would make to a donor.
Yes, you can make that case to a donor.
All right, I think we need to take a break for about 15 minutes, then we'll come back with the second session.
The second session will be on therapy.
On therapy, yeah.
Right.